Welcome to the AquariumMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 129, recorded September 3rd, 2012.
Yeah. Happy Labor Day to those of you who celebrate Labor Day.
Yes, so I hope you're all not working on Labor Day.
We're celebrating it right now by doing a podcast early.
Earlier in the day.
In the evening.
It's because Russ isn't working.
Right, so kind of nice. So.
Then we get that evening off. So, today, on our episode, we will be hearing from Robert in Boston.
Or perhaps Bob, so we'll have to ask him which one he prefers.
His email's Bob this time, so whichever one you want us to call you on the air. Brett, who apparently lives in cyberspace.
Yeah, I just didn't have a location for him, so.
What's that place in Tron called?
I don't remember.
I don't know, maybe that's where he's from, though. And Charlie in North Carolina.
All right.
So, you've been talking to Robert via email.
Yes,
about some things.
Been communicating about various things. He's wondering about his ram fry. He has German blue rams, kind of like Ann in Pittsburgh, and he's having a hard time raising them the same way as she is. And he's wondering, he's tried Walter worms, he's tried newly hatched brine shrimp, he's thinking about trying both infusoria and vinegar eels. So we were corresponding with that.
Okay.
So, so he's Kelly's got some things, and that's just kind of a summary of some of the things we've talked about, and then Kelly's going to get into his actual...
We'll cover a few of the things you guys corresponded about.
In detail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert says, I was changing the water in my baby ram tank the other day and was shocked, literally, when I placed the siphon tube into the water. That sounds painful. I tried dipping the tube a second time and received a second shock. This can't be happening, I thought, as I pulled out my cheapo emergency heater by the cord and to find it cracked and the coils exposed. So I reached across the tank to unplug it and immediately checked the tank for the small fry, all 15 of them. Then I thought to myself, what are you doing? How can you expect to find live baby fish when an adult primate can't even leave his fingers in the water for more than a second? So I shut off the light and half-heartedly slammed the heater into the garbage pail. No doubt I was more sad than angry because in some strange way I felt like those fish were my babies. Later on that night, I re-entered the room to turn off the lights in the other tanks when I saw a baby ram, and then another, and then another. I've heard of electric blue rams, but this is ridiculous. Is it possible I'm raising a strain of little Godzillas, or have I just seen too many bad Japanese sci-fi films?
Well, I'm hoping for the former, because that would be awesome.
We want one. If you have Godzillas, our sons would be so excited.
Yeah.
To get a Godzilla for their birthday.
Well, yeah, I wonder if it's different for the fish that are in the water. I do know that electric currents can bother fish in the water, of course. I mean, electric eels use them as weapons, so yes, they can bother fish. And other fish use them as basically echolocation devices, like night fish and so on. So, and then there are people who use their devices, basically a wiring configuration that is supposed to eliminate stray currents from the water of a tank, which is especially important, I guess, in saltwater tank, because the water conducts so well.
So much more.
So, it's strange that it doesn't seem to be affecting your rams. Interesting.
I don't know. Maybe they're superhero fish. So, then he goes on to talk about betas. He says, your concern about overextended beta bellies caught my attention. I have a young female beta that's never had a chance to release her eggs because apparently the show-quality copper-blue male she's living with is way too cool to mate with her. Silly boy. Said male will hereinafter be referred to as Sunny after the Drysdale Sun in the Beverly Hillbillies. Which, some of you who don't live in the U.S., just go to YouTube and type in the Beverly Hillbillies.
And then you might understand it, or it might just confuse you more.
And you might just think, what? Anyway, my young female was gorging on live mosquito larvae for the first time when I noticed her belly getting disproportionately fat, like a snake that just devoured a rabbit. Suddenly, eggs, lots of them, began dropping from her tube. I counted about 50 to 100, then another 75 hemorrhaged about 5 minutes later, and two more loads within the next 20 minutes or so. The same thing happened a few weeks later. All in all, I estimate she dropped 300 to 400 eggs each time. I know this doesn't qualify as bursting, but it reminded me of your observation.
Yeah, and you know, I've had that happen too.
Now, is that just, they get so full that they just... let go? They just have to come out?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I've had that happen with goldfish, and I think with bettas and maybe a couple of other species. I'm trying to remember what other species it may have happened with. But yeah, once in a while, they'll just do that.
They've just got too many, and they keep making them. And
yeah, and they've got to do something with it, I guess. Once they're ripe and they're ready to go.
Just drop them.
I know that some fish, in some occasions, can sort of recycle, you know.
They'll, like, they kind of reabsorb it?
Yeah, to some degree.
Use the materials over again?
I think so. Some fish will do that. But this, you know, a lot of times the fish, in this case, they'll release them and eat some of them. Or
so they recycle it that way.
And that can help, too. But other times they'll just seem to release them. And I've read about other fish doing it, like paradise fish, too. So, yeah, it must not be a terribly uncommon phenomenon if they can't find a male. Or if the male is, like, Sunny here.
Yeah, silly Sunny. I don't know. He thinks he's pretty awesome, I guess. The funny thing is, he says he found two baby bettas in the tank about a month after this happened. So he says, I guess Sunny built a nest or something like it in the far reaches of the 180-gallon tank. The tank is planted like a jungle, so I can't always observe everything that goes on and really don't want to disturb their environment.
Well, yeah, I guess Sunny's not too cool after all.
Yeah, or I don't know, he likes orphans, like.
How big were they when you found them? That would be interesting.
That would be, yeah, I don't know, he doesn't say. Okay, now he has a question about feeding very small fry.
Is this relates to what we were talking about. He was asking some question about infusoria, like, can you see the infusorians themselves in the water?
The little wiggly bits in the water.
And, let's see, he has some other questions like that, too, relating to that. But that was the one I remember right now. And so we corresponded for a little while about that. And I did mention that you can see, in some cases, depends on what kind of little critters you've got. But, that was one of the other ones, was what's the best way to see them? Should you use a magnifying glass or a microscope? And I have used a microscope, and when I have, I usually see rotifer-like things or paramecium-like things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've also seen them with the naked eye, just little motes, you know, especially if you get, like, slanted rays of sunlight hitting mm-hmm. the jar, you can see them sometimes, but you can't always. A lot of times there are plenty of edible creatures in there, and you can't see them. It just depends on what mix you get.
So how do you know when the culture's ripe enough to start feeding from?
Well, typically, if you don't have a microscope, you first it gets cloudy with the bacterial bloom, and then the clarity suddenly increases, maybe not completely clear, but not as cloudy as it was before, and that tends to indicate that the bacteria are being eaten by something bigger.
By the little critters.
Right, and then that means you have infusorians.
Oh. Does it turn green always?
No,
or not
it doesn't
always?
Actually.
They just call it green water sometimes?
Yeah, green water is what they call it when it does turn green.
Oh!
And so you have a lot of algae swimming around in there too.
Okay. And the algae is what turns it green?
Yes.
So you can have an infusoria culture that's not green, it just doesn't have algae in it.
Right, or not enough algae to turn the water green.
Do
whereas
you
a green water culture has infusorians in it as well, but is colored by a large number of algae living in it.
Is algae good?
Yes, it is.
Depending on the kind of fish.
Kind of depends on what you're feeding and what you've got, yeah.
So he has some more specific questions about delivery of infusoria, too.
Uh-huh.
He says, how did you get them near your fish? Did you squirt the infusoria in the general direction of the fish with a turkey baster? Would this be practical in a tank larger than 10 gallons?
Okay, well, with the bettas, which is my most recent example of using infusoria, I didn't use a turkey baster to try to direct it because the bettas were sort of spread around.
You did put it in with a turkey baster, didn't you?
Sometimes, but I didn't attempt to direct it.
Okay.
And sometimes I just poured it in.
Okay.
But I didn't attempt to direct it because the bettas were not in a group.
They were just spread all over the place.
The rams are often, you know, in a pretty tight group surrounding their parents. You know, their parents mm-hmm. are sort of herding them together. So it might actually be fruitful to try to do that with the rams.
That would make sense.
And I would say in a larger tank, it's probably the best bet because, say you have a 50-gallon tank and you're trying to do that, you can't really increase the density of the infusoria very much near the fish if you're just dumping them in one corner of the tank. You'd have to put an awful lot in there to be able to do that. So, yeah, I would say that's probably the best bet.
Okay. He goes on to say, I'm afraid my ram fry are dying of starvation. I've tried San Francisco Bay brine shrimp and Walter worms, but it appears they are slightly too large for hatchlings. A woman online said the only time she's had success with ram fry was when the tank included lots of guck, her term. and algae, both suspended and attached. This makes sense to me, but I've also heard that ram fry are absolutely intolerant of any nitrogenous waste and ammonia, so I'm not sure how the guck fits in. Tomorrow I'll throw some green water and hair algae from my Daphnia culture into the baby tank and hope for the best. Unfortunately, the infusoria culture is still cloudy.
You know, I mentioned to Robert on email that my Daphnia culture was the source for a lot of the infusoria that I was using. I would just take water out without Daphnia in it and put it in because I knew that there were infusoria in there for the first few days until our culture built up, because our culture
wasn't
cloudy
quite ready
too.
Yet when they
yeah,
hatched.
Right. So that may be helpful. What his plan sounds pretty good to me. And the thing with the guck and the nitrogenous waste, you know, yeah, I guess guck is so incredibly evocative, but not terribly descriptive.
Who knows what she means by guck?
We don't know exactly what she means, because it could refer to things that would contribute to nitrogenous waste in the water and so on, or it could be
something else. She may very well have just had green water going on in her fish tank, and she called that guck.
Yeah,
so they had infusoria to eat.
What she's talking about. But if it's suspended, then, yeah, suspended algae, it makes sense that she's going to have a lot of infusoria in the tank. I have had aquaria in those conditions before that seemed to do, where, you know, fry seemed to do well on occasions.
Lots to eat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a little while after that, we got another email from Robert, right?
Yep.
And he says, the ram fry have been free swimming for 2 days now, but won't touch the Walter worms. They seem to be small enough, but for some reason the rams struggle with them and then learn to ignore them completely. I believe that just like their parents and discus, ram babies have small mouths and are very picky eaters. Betta fry, on the other hand, though just as small or smaller than rams, aren't shy when it comes to eating. I've read that these pugnacious piscine pals, which, Robert, you get the prize for alliteration today, will tear the wings off a baby brine shrimp if they can't swallow them whole. Now, tell me, brine shrimp don't have wings.
Well,
tell me what that means.
That has the structures that they have, the swimming structures that they have when they first hatch.
Is it different from their little...
You know, they start out with basically one or two sets. I can never remember if it's one or two sets. I think it's one. They have one set of them at first.
Okay.
And as they molt, you know, they add them.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe they only have one set. And so if you look at them in, like, a electron microscope's photograph, they almost do look sort of like wings. There are these structures sticking off, and they have these little fringes on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's referring to.
What are they called? The things that look like legs on the side that they... undulate and that
phylopods.
Phylopods.
Yeah.
So that needs to be in a band name somewhere. Phylopods.
Yeah, it means something like leaf feet.
Oh.
Yeah. So there you go. But I think that I've noticed some interesting things too that relate to this. Walter worms, when we first gave them to our betta fry, they did a similar thing. They would grab one, and the worm would wiggle around and kind of slap them in the face.
And
they would spit it out.
Yeah.
They would let go. The bettas would. And I was worried, oh, they're not going to eat them. They'd eat the vinegar eels, but not the Walter worms at first. But after a couple of days, you know, the Walter worms started being more palatable for whatever reason. And
the fish had gotten a little bit bigger, so the Walter worms couldn't slap them as much.
And nowadays, they'll eat hundreds of them, you know, every day. That's what their morning meal is, and usually their noon meal, so...
Now, if ram are traditionally kind of a picky fish, would it maybe be a helpful strategy to wait until they're a little bit bigger before trying the Walter worms so that they don't get discouraged too soon
just
quit trying with them?
Could be, because if they're eating the vinegar eels, which are much like Walter worms, but quite a bit smaller, they might have some strategies sort of that could help them eat the Walter worms.
Some hunting strategies?
Because I have read about this, and fish actually learn a lot about eating with different types of food. They go through quite a learning curve. I mean, that might sound funny to some people, but completely
common sense to others.
Well,
they're alive, and they have to exist. They have to keep surviving, so they have to learn.
But it does take them a while to learn how to deal with new foods, and so it could be that would be a good idea. Start with vinegar eels, wait a few days, and then go on to the Walter worms.
So Robert goes on to say, twice in the last month, I've had batches of 300 to 400 fry disappear into the third day of their free-swimming stage, probably starving to death. Infusoria is my main focus now, and the jars with turnip cubes and canned green beans are producing too few too slowly. Just like that, my plan to breed rams has morphed into a project on how to raise large enough quantities of infusoria. All the while reading how easy it is on the internet. Very frustrating. This is truly the nitty-gritty of the aquarium hobby.
And now you get the quote prize of the day, too.
Yes, you do. So, Oh, he has a funny thing in here. It says, "But let's not end this visit on a depressing note. I have a completely gratuitous and unnecessary question for Kelly. Where do beneficial aquarium bacteria reside?" And I believe the answer that he's looking for is surface area! And on that note, let's take our break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Now.
Okay, carrying on, we have a quick question from Brett, and he says, "Do aquarium hose sizes refer to the internal or external diameter of the hose?" That's okay. A good question, because they have kind of a thickish wall, don't they?
Right, so it's very significant when you're trying to find barbed fittings or clamps or different things, like you need to know that. Even though with certain clamps and barbed fittings, you have a range, you still need to know. Most of them refer to the internal diameter, but not always. I mean, you look and see, sometimes you'll see one that's labeled, a few of them will have both, and it'll have like ID, internal diameter, it'll have certain number of millimeters, and then another one will be OD, outer diameter.
Oh, okay,
and
so...
And then it'll have another...
They just put the initials on.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So, but generally, it's the inner one, so thank you, Brett. That is a... Good question. It comes in handy a lot of times. It's a very practical thing to think about.
Yep. That's there good go. Stuff. Okay, we have another from Charlie. We've got an email from Charlie in North Carolina. He says, "Hope you all have had a wonderful summer. Thank you very much. It's been pretty good. Busy.
But pretty good.
I always think, oh, I have these, you know, ambitious plans for stuff I'm going to do with the kids and... La la la, and it never happens.
Oh, well, hey, we're getting their science projects done with
the bettas. That's true, we did get that. We've got that. So Charlie says, "I've noticed some hydra on the glass of my RCS tank. Remind me again what RCS means."
Red cherry shrimp.
Red cherry shrimp. I shouldn't know that by now. "Probably came in on plants. I have seen one eat a whole Daphnia back when I was in school. Are they a threat to small shrimp? If so, how can I get rid of them? Couldn't find much info online."
Okay, well, there are quite a few aquarists who agree that the red cherry shrimp can be damaged when they're young by hydra, and perhaps even when they're a little older. But
are they really small enough when they're little that the hydra can attack them?
Well, it depends on the hydra whether or not they could, because some hydra are really small and others are a bit bigger, but I think there's no doubt that they can at least damage new red cherry shrimp, and in many cases, if the hydra's large enough, it could eat them. But
so
they, if they sting them without eating them, it could still damage them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, what should we...
Well, what should we do about it?
Yeah, what can he do to get rid of the hydra?
Well, this is a great thing. I'm glad to be able to say this, because I couldn't always say this, but because I, in the past, have had trouble with hydra that... were hard to resolve for various reasons. Not too long ago, and it may have been through Mick or Juliet, I'm not sure, I just can't recall exactly, but I found out that you can take care of them with a deworming medicine.
Well, that sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah, we may have talked about it before. For certain parasites of red cherry shrimp, I'm not sure, or planaria. Anyway, you can use Panicure.
Is that just at normal fish stores, pet stores?
Well, you sometimes have to get it through a veterinarian.
Oh, okay.
And you may be able to find it somewhere else, too, or online or whatever, but Panicure,
it's a worming medicine for, like, dogs and cats? Or horses? Or?
It's used for mammals.
Oh, okay.
Panacur, Panicure. But it can be used for hydra.
It's
and
not Panicure.
No.
Panic! It's got worms!
Right. And it can be used for... in that way, fairly effectively. So,
How do you know the dosage? The vet probably doesn't know fish hydrate killing doses.
Probably not. I don't remember it offhand, but this is what I would do. In Charlie's case, I would go online and do a search for Hydra Panicure.
See what comes up.
And I'm sure there...
Do we have it in another episode, then?
We have discussed it in other episodes. So if you look up Hydra in on our site, it'd probably show up. Do a search for Aquaramex.
If the person who told us about that is listening, maybe write in and if you've got more info on dosage and stuff.
Yeah, if I remember right, both Mick and Juliet talked about it to some extent.
Did they?
Yeah, I think so. So we'll look into that and try to see if we can... let us know, Charlie, what you find out when you look for that. But I would say that's probably your best bet.
Okay, we have a few bits of baby beta news.
Right. Well, 6 weeks old today.
Happy birthday.
We were noticing a lot of interesting coloration in terms of what appears to be early butterfly coloration. Some of them in red, many of them in red, and some...
Some in blue. They have kind of a really light iridescent blue.
Yeah, so we'll see how that turns out. Ventral fins clearly visible on most of the fish. More aggression.
Did you already talk about you saw the two different pupil colors?
Oh, I don't know if I said that or not. I may have, but some of them have solid dark eyes, black eyes, and others have irises that you can see is a lighter color. And it's been interesting. I would say that we did start jarring them, didn't we? We've got several of them jarred
now,
right? And we need to jar more as they become aggressive and larger. So we need to jar some more today. And so each of the kids has their own, they're starting. Mm-hmm. We've got them labeled so they know which one is theirs that they're taking care of. And we're going to assign a certain number to each of them so they can do their science projects with them.
Now, I know you were saying if there was one thing that you could go back and do differently, it would to be decapsulating the brine shrimp from the very beginning.
Right, because it's been so easy, a lot easier than I thought. I just do a decapsulation, a batch of decapsulated brine shrimp cysts about once a week. Store the rest in the fridge in the heavily saline water. Mm-hmm. And it makes it a little easier every day to collect them, to start them, all that kind of thing. But
don't
also
have a dangerous problem of them possibly swallowing a non-decapsulated, unhatched cyst.
Right, and I don't have to deal with that. The hatch rate seems great with it, and it doesn't seem to decrease over time during the week. I mean, I don't know for longer terms if I could decap enough for a month, say. I don't know. Maybe not. But it's working great to do it once a week, and that's good enough. And I'm just overjoyed we don't have to worry about them swallowing anything they shouldn't swallow, and they seem to be doing really well.
Yep.
Haven't had any more belly sliders appear, and some of them actually seem to be getting better, a few of them.
Yeah, it almost looks like they've regained some capacity or regrown?
I don't know how that all works. I know with goldfish, they can have swim bladder trouble and then they can recover from it. I don't know if that's the same thing that's going on here or not. And some of them don't seem to be recovering, but others seem to have recovered partially or completely. So, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
If any of those of you out there who have been breeding bettas and have noticed any phenomena similar to that or contrary to that, let us know. It'd be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, thank you to all of you. To Charlie, to Brett, and to Robert, or Bob, if you want to be called that instead. And
our betas.
Our betas. May the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquaramax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquaramax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquaramax.com.